Well, good morning. I hope we're ready to start, and we're in, my reckoning is correct, we're in lesson 13 of the My Son Wisdom and Folly Discourses, and this is the 10th section that we've looked at. So we're going to look at chapter 8 today. And I hope to cover the whole chapter. There's a lot of material today, but I'm going to skip over part of it. And if you have questions about some of those sections, then we'll see if we can take them at the end. Let's read Proverbs 8. Does not wisdom cry out and understanding lift up her voice? She takes her stand at the top of the high hill, beside the way where the paths meet. She cries out by the gates at the entry of the city, at the entrance of the doors. To you, O men, I call, and my voice is to the sons of men. O you simple ones, understand prudence, and you fools, be of an understanding heart. Listen, for I will speak of excellent things, and from the opening of my lips will come right things. For my mouth will speak truth. Wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the words of my mouth are with righteousness. Nothing crooked or perverse is in them. They are all plain to him who understands and right to those who find knowledge. Receive my instruction and not silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is better than rubies, and all the things one may desire cannot be compared with her. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence and find out knowledge and discretion. The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride and arrogance in the evil way, and the perverse mouth I hate. Counsel is mine, sound wisdom. I am understanding. I have strength. By me kings reign and rulers decree justice. By me princes rule and nobles, all the judges of the earth. I love those who love me, and those who seek me diligently will find me. Riches and honor are with me, enduring riches and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, yes, than fine gold, and my revenue than choice silver. I traverse the way of righteousness in the midst of the paths of justice, that I may cause those who love me to inherit wealth, that I may fill their treasuries. The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way, before his works of old. I have been established from everlasting, from the beginning, before there was ever an earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth, where there were no fountains. Abounding with water. Before the mountains were settled, before the hills I was brought forth, while as yet he had not made the earth or the fields, or the primal dust of the world. When he prepared the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep, when he established the clouds above, when he strengthened the fountains of the deep, when he assigned to the sea its limits so that the waters would not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was beside him as a master craftsman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him, rejoicing in his inhabited world, and my delight was with the sons of men. Now therefore, listen to me, my children, for blessed are those who keep my ways. Hear instruction and be wise, and do not disdain it. Blessed is the man who listens to me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at the posts of my doors. For whoever finds me finds life and obtains favor from the Lord. But he who sins against me wrongs his own soul, and those who hate me love death. Things can change rather vividly in the life of Proverbs, one chapter to the next. In chapter 7, we had a vivid and compelling story of a son's decline into misery and ruin and death. But chapter 8, things turn and we now have a vivid portrayal of wisdom. George Horn, by way of Bridges in his commentary, describes this chapter very well when he says, "Imagination cannot form to itself a more exquisite and affecting piece of scenery upon this subject than that exhibited by King Solomon in the book of Proverbs, a book whose end and design is to teach us the true knowledge of good and evil, that we may pursue the one and avoid the other." And in the seventh chapter, under the usual figure of a harlot, loosely decked in a profusion, a vain ornament, he induces the world, or the false wisdom thereof, by its several fictitious charms and meretricious blandishments, alluring the unwary to the chambers of destruction. In the succeeding chapter, by way of perfect contrast, appears in beauty and majesty of holiness the offspring of the Almighty, the Son of God, the true and eternal wisdom of God, with all the tender love and affectionate concern of a parent inviting men to the substantial joys and unfading pleasures of immorality in the house of salvation. It's kind of a long quote, but I hope it conveys this idea that Solomon has been, in these last chapters, trying to paint very vivid pictures especially. And in chapter 7, it was a picture of the decline and death of the son. And in chapter 8, he's saying the house of salvation is so glorious, you want to go to that house. That's the path you want to be on. Not the path of the harlot, not the path of the strange woman. You want the beauty of the house over here, not the beauty of the woman over here. And so this chapter has some controversy attached to it. I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I will mention some of the controversy, but we're not going to spend quite a bit of time on it. And wisdom is personified here, and so the literary style, the device that's employed in chapter 8 is that of personification. So the very first sentence tells us this. Does not wisdom cry out? Well, wisdom doesn't have a voice. Wisdom doesn't exist in the air. Doesn't have a temporal body. So it's not literally crying out, right? That's not what's being said. We're here to imagine wisdom crying out. And as wisdom is portrayed, as wisdom is depicted moving through this chapter, some things subtly shift in the description from this dispassionate third-person account, right? Does not wisdom cry out? Well, wisdom's not saying this, right? Somebody's describing wisdom, and understanding lift up her voice. So we're seeing this parallelism, this synonymous linking between wisdom and understanding. Here we have understanding lifting up her voice, and we find that she is the one who takes her stand here and there. But we're not finding these words to be wisdom's words. We're finding these words to be the words of someone who's describing wisdom. So, but things change. It's not like that through the whole chapter. So we'll discuss some of those shifts and change so we can better appreciate who is speaking and why they're saying what they're saying as we move through the chapter. But I think it's important we not rush to judgment as to who wisdom is until we first see what device is being used to describe wisdom. And that device is personification, right? So that's really important to get, because the thing personified is not the thing itself. The thing personified is an illustration of the thing itself. And that's an important distinction. All right, so Solomon opens this chapter with this somewhat rhetorical question: does not wisdom cry out? I'm not sure why he words it this way. You could also fill in the second half: does not understanding lift up her voice? But he starts this section with a forceful declaration here of the efforts of wisdom, right? Wisdom is crying. Wisdom is shouting. She's lifting up her voice. She wants to be heard. And the places where she does this appear to take her everywhere. She does it on a high hill. She does it on the way. She does it in the path. She does it by the gate. She does it by the entry at the city. She does it at the entrance of the doors. And wisdom is very active in her work of crying out so people will hear. And I hope this brings to mind Proverbs chapter 1, where we also heard of the way wisdom was crying out. Wisdom was communicating. So wisdom in the concourses, in the open squares, the opening of the gates, here's where she's speaking her words. And the picture Solomon wants us to remember back in chapter 1 and to think about here in chapter 8 is how wisdom is everywhere. Wisdom is seeking. Wisdom is out looking. Wisdom is trying to find people to hear her voice. She wants her voice to be heard. And she wants her voice to be heard by everyone. And I think we're to imagine this contrast between the way wisdom conducts herself. She's crying out. She's going high and low. And that of the harlot in the last chapter. What was she doing? She went from place to place. Does anyone remember the word used to describe her conduct in moving from place to place? She was lurking. That's right. Wisdom is not lurking. Wisdom is open and declaring what needs to happen. So wisdom is a very different person than the harlot. So sometimes wisdom is called Lady Wisdom. People like to try to fill in the picture even more, Madam Harlot and Lady Wisdom. I'm not so sure those things are all that helpful, but wisdom, the gender of the word is feminine, and she's described as a she. It's her voice, and she does this, and she does that. It's because of the way the word was structured. So we find the two women of Proverbs 7 and Proverbs 8 striking a very different tone, literally and figuratively. They're walking through the city with differences, different goals and different agendas on their mind. So when wisdom, the message of wisdom is to whom? Solomon doesn't start this passage with my son, I want you to think about this, or my children, or my sons, or ye sons, and when it's not so personal. He simply declares, does wisdom not do this? And then in verse 4, we find that the voice has changed, right? So it's no longer Solomon describing wisdom. She does this, she does that. But to you, O men, I call. So wisdom is just issuing this universal declaration, this universal call for people to come and hear. My voice is to the sons of men. The voice of wisdom is meant to be heard, and it's meant to be heard by man. People, men and women, need to hear the voice of wisdom. And in particular, she's calling for the simple ones. Oh, you simple ones, understand prudence, and you fools, be of an understanding heart. And if you remember back in chapter 7, the person who was looking through the lattice, right, who was looking down on the city and could see the lurking harlot, she could also see, presumably it's wisdom there, she could also see the woman and the harlot itself and the young man. But when she was looking out, she saw among the simple. She was looking among those simple ones. And she identified, these guys are clueless, they don't have any idea. Well, here in chapter 8, wisdom is also calling and looking for the clueless, looking for the simple-minded, but for different reasons. The harlot wanted to bed them so that they could fall into death. What wisdom wants is to save them. So the idea, and I want, this is by way of refresher, the idea behind this simple person is someone who is a silly person, one who's easily persuaded and enticed. So it's not just that they can be talked into something, they can be attracted to something rather easily. The commentator Phillips gave us a definition of the simple as the open-minded person. And he's open-minded because there isn't anything of substance there. His mind is dangerously open. And that's the difference. He's not open-minded in a virtuous sort of way, willing to hear other people's perspective. He's open-minded in a dangerous sort of way. He's gullible and he's naive. He may have opinions, but he lacks a deeply thought-through and field-tested set of convictions. The man literally will believe anything. And he can be enticed to believe anything. So what is it that the simple needs? Well, he needs prudence. And prudence is to learn how to think with care and thoughtfulness. The prudent are people who are shrewd and crafty, but not in a nefarious sort of way. They're, you know, we tend to think of the shrewd and the crafty, I think, depicted is they're the ones who are lurking with back deals, trying to always take advantage of someone. But here, this shrewd and crafty person is someone who can marshal or utilize the resources they have available to make wise decisions and to bring about a desired end. And this idea of the simple is common through Scripture. I don't want you to think that, well, they're simple and we're not. No, the call is to all young men, all children are simple-minded, right? This matrix that I was referring to earlier, that they learn to measure and see things, has to be constructed. And so when we, Psalm 19:7 tells us the law of the Lord is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. God's word was designed to help people who are simple. And folks come into the world simple, and they need to be made, or they need to be gifted with prudence. Psalm 119:130 tells us, the entrance of your words gives light, and it gives understanding to the simple, something that they can acquire for themselves. The simple need a complex way to think. So, as I mentioned at the opening of the class, Proverbs is a hard book to translate, in part because words mean different things. There's a lot of nuance, and we might have more words than the Hebrews did, but the Hebrews have four or five different words for the fool. And it looks to me that this particular verse, you fools, be of an understanding heart, we first heard of a fool back at the opening in 1:7. The fool despises wisdom, and he mocks when guilty. You know, he won't respect the authority. He's quarrelsome and he's licentious. But and there's a certain level of impiety attached to that individual. But this word denotes maybe impiety a bit more broadly. This isn't the same word for fool that was used in chapter 1. This word is kessel or kessel. And it really means a stupid fellow, a dullard, a simpleton, and an arrogant one. And he's also impious, but he's just not very bright. And so the idea, I think, here is that people who have not yet learned to form rightly the way to think, the thoughts and conclusions they need to come to, and for those who are of just not very smart, they need an understanding heart. They need to get set on the right path so that they can understand. This person, one of his problems is he thinks he's right. He's not smart enough to know that he isn't right. He thinks he's right, and he needs a better way to think. So when wisdom is speaking, her first command, to look at it this way, is in verse 6, listen. Listen to me. I am speaking. I want you to hear. You have an obligation. It's in your best interest to hear what I'm saying. She's going to speak of excellent things. And the opening of my lips will come right things. And the idea behind this section is the nobility and the honor as subject matter for what wisdom wants to describe. In Proverbs 2:9, we have this same word for the right things. Opening my lips will come right things. We have it's a hard word to translate, but we get in Proverbs 2:9 the idea of equity is how it's commonly translated. So I want to teach you the things that will put you on a path of nobility and honor in your dealings with folks so that you're walking in those paths of justice and equity that were mentioned earlier. So in verse 7, we find a contrast. My mouth will speak truth, and wickedness is an abomination to my lips. Wisdom is loved, and wickedness is abominated. And this, again, the book of Proverbs is a book of contrast. It's not just one-sided. Wisdom is active in both sides of the equation. With verse 8, when we see this righteousness, the words of my mouth are righteousness. There's nothing crooked or perverse in them. We have in chapter 2, verse 9, we were reminded that wisdom is speaking of righteousness. What she tells us is good and can be trusted. And then in verse 9, they're plain to him who understands. It's sort of an interesting qualifier, isn't it? It's not that what I say is objectively plain. It's plain to those who understand and right to those who find knowledge. So there's a presupposing of a disposition of the individual. When wisdom calls, not everybody thinks, well, that makes sense, right? That's good. I see righteousness, justice, equity. I'm content with that. These are right things. Some people say, that's nonsense. In fact, that's the definition of the fool, is he thinks he's right in his own mind, and he wants to mock, he wants to disregard, he cannot see the value of it. But wisdom is plain to those who understand and right to those who find knowledge. You've got to be of the right disposition to understand. And that's a really dangerous thing to say, right? I mean, you don't want to go tell people, I'd like to explain the Bible to you, but you're not right yet to understand it. But in a sense, that's what wisdom is saying. Not right in the sense of being good enough, but you're not of a humble heart. And that's one of the contrasts we'll see a little bit later, is the importance of not being proud and arrogant. What wisdom is saying, you need to humble yourself and listen to me. You need to take a back seat and subsume your understanding and your authority to mine, because what I'm saying is noble. It's up here. It's right. I think Solomon wants us to find the ideas captured in Proverbs 2 and Proverbs 3 in this opening section. And in fact, I think Proverbs 8 is a brilliant summary, while also introducing some new figures for us to think about, new ways to think about wisdom. But it's largely a chapter of summaries. And so chapter 2 and 3 are in mind in the opening of Proverbs 8, 1 through 11. So, let me back up here just a minute. We find, I want to mention this briefly because it's repeated later in verse 10. The value of instruction over silver and knowledge over gold is given, and we're going to see that this is a theme that was certainly mentioned back in chapter 3, but it will be mentioned again at the end of this chapter. And there's a phrase here very similar in verse 11 that comes back from Proverbs 3, 14 and 15. In chapter 3, we see, for her proceeds are better than the profits of silver, and her gain than fine gold. She is more precious than rubies, and all the things you may desire cannot be compared with her. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. And it's an outrageous statement, isn't it? To think that all the things that you could desire, all the gold and silver, choice gold and fine gold, as it's mentioned later, everything your heart could want, whether it's women or whether it's money and riches, wealth, nothing can be compared to wisdom. And this was introduced to Solomon to be careful not to be enticed by the wrong things when he was talking to his sons, and we're reminded about it here again. So I don't know how else you would communicate the value of wisdom to young men other than describing that here is the method by which they'll make their way in the world. You're going to need money. You might even want to be rich. You might want a wife. And I don't know what Solomon was thinking, but it certainly wasn't unheard of for people to have more than one wife. It's not something that God designed, but it's something that was practiced. And Solomon's trying to reach his sons by describing to them things of beauty and things of marvel and things that are to be desired. So he's trying to reach these boys where they're at so that they can learn the other side of the story. And it's an arresting depiction of just how valuable wisdom is as he describes her, with the idea that everything you desire, everything, cannot compare to the beauty of finding wisdom. All right, so we move to this next section. We'll have to keep things moving here. I'm sorry for the speed, but I did want to finish this chapter. We find wisdom giving us more of her words. Wisdom is now describing herself in a different sort of way. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence. Earlier, as I'm calling out to the sons of men, I've got something of value. So she's describing her worth, but now she's describing herself a bit more in a different light. So in verse 12, I, wisdom, dwell with prudence. Prudence is what the simple man needed earlier, and prudence is what she's offering. You come listen to me, and you need understanding and prudence, you can get it. I, wisdom, I dwell with prudence. I can give you these things. This word is used several times, and I think only in Proverbs. But in verse 13, we find the great hinge of the book of Proverbs. Remember, the great hinge is the fear of the Lord. Is what? The what? The beginning of wisdom. And fools despise the instruction they receive. And here, we find the fear of the Lord depicted differently in its opposite form. The fear of the Lord here is to hate evil. It's really strong language, isn't it? It's almost easier for us to conceive of the need to love something than it is for us to conceive of the importance of learning to hate something. But that's exactly what's in mind here. The flip side of learning about the value and adoring wisdom is learning how to hate the wickedness that's around. And specifically, we find a number of ways in which wickedness is being depicted. And I think, in part, it not only sends us to ruin, but it does so because it keeps us from acquiring the right form of wisdom. So, the fear of the Lord is redefined by five different things. Evil, right? I hate evil. The fear of the Lord hates evil. What else do I hate? I hate pride. I hate arrogance. I hate the evil way. And I hate a froward or a perverse mouth. So Solomon's drawing us back to chapter 1, where he says this is what the fear of the Lord is, right? It's the beginning of wisdom. And he's depicting what the fool hates, right? I mean, in a sense, that's what Proverbs 1:7 is describing for us, is what is it that the fool hates? The fool hates all this instruction. He hates this wisdom. And over here we find, well, what is it that wisdom hates? Wisdom hates the fool. Wisdom hates the person who's proud and arrogant and evil and perverse. The person who is always twisting the way. Everybody's got to hate. Everybody. That's the picture being presented to us in Proverbs, is that everybody has to learn how to hate. The question is, are you going to hate wisdom, or are you going to hate the things wisdom hates? Now, I mention this in more for its novelty, because I really don't understand why, but in 13, this idea of pride, this is the only time this word is used in the Bible, it's in Proverbs 8:13. It simply means pride and arrogance. And what I notice is that the gender is feminine, but the gender, the word for arrogance, is masculine. I don't know what role that might play, or whether Solomon was capitalizing on something that his son would pick up. Is he merely being poetical and repeating the word? Because they both have similar meanings, right? Pride and arrogance. And I don't know if he's saying, look, it encompasses A to Z, and he's giving them this idea to make it easier to understand and to memorize. But the commentator Delitzsch remarked on this conjunction here of that we're to understand the full scope of pride and arrogance, or what wisdom hates, that there's an umbrella that stretches over all pride and arrogance. So I'm not sure what else to make of it, but I offer that as something to consider. But in verse 13, I think we find a really helpful way of approaching life and approaching the book, the rest of Proverbs. If you are puffed up, if you are full of yourself, if you're swelled with your own understanding, I think is a valid way of describing this, or if you walk in a way that's contrary to the way of holiness, that's the froward and perverse and the evil way that's being mentioned here, or that you have words which are stubborn or contrary to that which is sound and true, then wisdom hates you. That's the conclusion to draw. If you are swelled with your own understanding, if you are stubborn with your words and the way in which you walk, or you speak in a way that is perverse, wisdom hates you. That's what she says. It's the fear of the Lord to hate evil. There are other aspects of it. Counsel is mine, sound wisdom, I'm understanding, I have strength. And here we start to see how wisdom is asserting herself and all the different ways in which she is responsible for the world that we find. Wisdom continues her autobiography by describing herself as possessing counsel, wisdom, understanding, strength. They belong to her. I have these things. In verses 15 and 16, this idea of king's reign and ruler's decree, some have taken this as the idea that kings rule well when they rule with wisdom, and rulers rule well when they rule with wisdom. Well, I mean, that's a no-brainer. I mean, you know, all administration done wisely is better, right? But I don't think that's what Solomon's getting at. I think what wisdom is saying is, I establish kings and rulers. My wisdom and counsel are so vast and so important. My authority is so important that kings reign and rulers rule, princes rule, the nobles rule, the judges of the earth, because of the importance of my wisdom. And in verse 17, we find, again, we shift. I love those. So wisdom is not simply describing her attributes in a negative fashion. Here are all the things I hate. But then she turns around and brings comfort, which is in opposition to the harlot, right? The harlot didn't love that boy. She didn't love him. She loved the night of pleasure, but she didn't love the boy. And here we find wisdom saying, I love those who love me. And those who seek me diligently will find me. That's an amazing promise, isn't it? To be set in the middle of wisdom sort of asserting herself and saying, here is all the power and authority I have. This is how important I am. And rightfully so. But then she stoops to us and says, I love those who love me. If you love wisdom, wisdom loves you. And I promised you'll find wisdom if you diligently seek after it. If you, this idea of diligence is that of rising early and being aggressive and earnest in finding it. So wisdom is saying, if you're putting forth effort to find me, I love you, and you will find me. Then in verses 18 to 21, we find, again, we're back to this idea of riches and wealth. Riches and honor are with me. They are hers to dispense. Enduring riches, my fruit is better than gold, than fine gold, than choice silver. I hope this brings you right back to mind in Proverbs 3, verses 13 to 18, that we find that there is genuine happiness with people who find wisdom and gain understanding. And in part because wisdom has the ability to bestow upon an individual true and genuine wealth, wealth that's worth possessing. And in fact, in verse 17 of Proverbs 3, we find that her ways are ways of pleasantness and her paths are paths of peace. And she is a tree of life to those who take hold of her, and happy are all who retain her. So these promises that were initially given in chapter 3, I think are brought forward for us to be thinking about again, to be reminded. Remember, it's the lather, rinse, repeat method. That's the method of learning in Proverbs. And we find in verse 19, I don't think it's coincidental, this idea of my fruit. Well, where did this fruit come from? It came from the tree. And what tree is going to produce life and peace and pleasantness? Well, it's the tree back in the garden that God intended for us to have. And I think what we find Solomon saying is, goodness and truth and genuine wealth are all awaiting you if you will diligently seek me. I have these in my possession. God is not stingy in his distribution of wealth to his people. He's not stingy at all. And we're going to move to the next section. This is where this passage has created a lot of controversy in the history of the church. We find many, many commentators see that the description of wisdom can only be applied to the Lord Jesus Christ. They see this as a type of Christ. They see Christ in Proverbs 8. And there's a great deal of effort to show how each of these descriptions of what appear to be the attributes of wisdom were manifested in Christ. You know, for instance, she she goes to the hills. Christ preached from the tops of hills, and when wisdom, I don't want to go into all of it. There's a lot there. So people see Jesus, and there's nothing wrong with seeing Jesus in this. But this is a 1000 BC poetical work, which means it's dense, it's terse, and it's utilizing personification. And I think we need to see that first, and then we move to see how it might apply in the future. So I think the Spirit is speaking in Proverbs 8, obviously, but I think the Spirit is speaking to direct us to Christ, but at the same time, we have to be careful about how tightly we want to couple the particular passages, because it's not easy translating this style of work, especially when we have brighter texts to help illustrate the truths that were under question. So, for instance, in verse 22, the Lord possessed me at the beginning of his way. Some have translated that created. That word is, sometimes it's translated purchased. So the Lord purchased me or possessed me. I don't think it means created. The commentators are pretty overwhelming that it's not, that we shouldn't think of it this way. But one of the errors that arose from the misunderstanding of this passage was that of Arianism, which was dealt with in the 4th century, as Arius was asserting that Jesus was a created individual, maybe from a long time ago, but he was created, and therefore does not share in substance with the Father. And this passage was seen as a passage supporting his argument. And so he was refuted, and that doctrine has been settled for 1,600 years now. It's not a question that's open for debate, and this is not, I don't think this says what Arius thought it said. The Council of Nicaea agreed. Church history has agreed to it, but this was a point of contention, because if Jesus was created, then this would seem to say it, and I don't think that's what it says, but that's how it was taken. But let's look in verses 24 to 29, what exactly it is that wisdom made. So the scope of wisdom's work is absolutely everywhere in creation. Verse 24, we find depths and fountains, right? When there were no depths, I was there, asserting her age and asserting her work. Mountains and hills, and 25 and 26, we have the earth, the fields, the primal dust. 27, we have the heavens and the circle on the face of the deep. I'm puzzled over that phrase, what it means exactly. It seems to be an interesting phrase, but I don't know what its implications are. In verse 28, we find the clouds, and again, these references to the fountains and to the deep. And in verse 29, we see the sea, and we see the sea in particular with having a limit that was set for it. The shorelines and waters not transgressing. So there's an idea that when creation took place, God established these boundaries, and wisdom is saying, this is what I did during this time. The foundations of the earth, we find the idea of boundaries and establishing areas to be part of the work of what wisdom did during creation. And then then we get to verse 30, I was beside him as a master craftsman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing always before him. Solomon describes the relationship that Yahweh has with wisdom as one of delight and one of pleasure. Twice, wisdom describes herself as being the delight of Yahweh and the one in whom Yahweh rejoiced, which is also mentioned twice. If Solomon's going to put this much effort into reminding us what is at stake here, we should stop and make a point of pulling that into our mind. Wisdom is a delight to God. It brings him pleasure. It makes him laugh, is how the words can be translated. Yahweh takes great delight in the beauty of wisdom, and it's a gift he offers us, accompanied with love. You love me, I love you. and I will give you wisdom if you will diligently seek it. In verses 32 to 36, as we draw this last section to a close, we find this command to listen. Now therefore, listen to me, my children, in 32 and in 33, hear instruction and be wise. Listen and be wise. It could be translated either way. We also find it in verse 34, blessed is the man who does what? Who listens to me. We also found it in verse 6, when wisdom said, listen to me when I'm speaking. So four times the act of listening is depicted in Proverbs 8, and it's for a good reason. This listening to God's word of the contrast from the puffed up man who doesn't want to hear that word because he thinks he already understands. But wisdom is saying, listen, 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 listen to me. And what will happen? You will be blessed. You're going to be blessed. And I need you to be diligent. It's not just that I love those who love me, but if you diligently seek me, you'll find me. What's he saying in 34? Listen. Now watch. Watch daily at my gates, waiting at the post of my doors. Well, where are these gates and doors, right? I mean, we don't have the same physical gates. That's not the point. But the point of the gates and the doors, that's where wisdom has been, right? Wisdom, up at the beginning of the chapter and then back in 2 and 3, or in chapter 1, wisdom is everywhere. Wisdom's on the hill. Wisdom's at the gates. She's at the entrance of the city. She's not like the harlot who's traveling about. And so when you've got the opportunity to acquire wisdom, be diligent about it and watch to be diligent so that you can get wisdom. And then finally, we find if you find me, you find life. That's a wonderful promise that wisdom has. If you find me, you find life. If you find me, you obtain favor from the Lord. But if you sin against me, you sin against your own soul, and you turn out to actually love death. It's a beautiful contrast to the end of what it means to be diligent and pursue wisdom and what will happen if you don't. All right, that was long and fast. I know there was a lot of material, but I hope some of this will trigger your own reading of Proverbs, that when you pass through it, you say, I heard those words before. I need to be paying attention right here, but we certainly have some time for questions and comments.
Verse 35, I think it's a good illustration of, you know, whoever finds me finds life, how wisdom and Jesus are directly connected. You know, Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life, but not necessarily the same thing. But I think that helps to reinforce that fact. You know, if you find wisdom, yes, you can find Christ, but they're still, you know, they're tied at the hip, but not necessarily the same person.
That's right. It's a good point. Different ways of looking at Christ, seeing him as the way, the truth, the life. I mean, it's not just one perspective. He's multifaceted. That's good. Sam?
I think 36, we can really see this exemplified in our culture today, just kind of the culture of death in one sense. We've got abortion. We've got kind of infatuation with death in a lot of our culture right now, so I think it's a sad representation of that, but you can see it being worked out. Those who don't seek wisdom love death, and we see that exemplified in various ways in our culture.
Yeah, we sure do. Anybody else? Logan.
I was going to ask what are some of the more interesting or likely views you encountered on the circle on the face of the waters?
At times it was very sparse. Trying to remember, I think it most tried to reflect back on the forming of the world itself. In the chapter 1 of Genesis, the Spirit sort of hovering over that which was formless and forming it, drawing this circle. But I don't know. I didn't walk away thinking, oh, that really makes a lot of sense. I was a bit puzzled. Which reminds us, Proverbs needs to be meditated on. I'm finding I don't see things until I've sat and simply looked at it and thought about it for a while. And it's hard. Comments? Questions? Oh,
did. The New King James?
Yes. Yes.
Pride and arrogance, that section there, the real conflict is seen a lot in the life, for example, in the life of Jesus. As we read through, our family has been reading through the Gospel of Luke, and there's he's arguing a lot with the Pharisees, and the scribes and the Pharisees and leaders, who seem to be extremely proud people. Then there's exceptions to every group, right? But you have this parable of the tax collector and the Pharisee going up to pray, one being proud, one being humble. And you had him talking about the easier for the camel to go through the eye of the needle than for a rich man to enter the kingdom of God. And the rich are usually often characterized by pride. Look how well they've done. They don't need these things, the gospel and so on. All their trust in their wealth and so on. So you just see again and again and again how opposed pride and arrogance are to the message of the gospel. Just deaf ears and so on that don't want to be cracked. That shell doesn't want to be cracked. And you see it.
Yeah, this is Solomon repeatedly illustrates that these are not just intellectual problems. These are deeply moral problems. That it's not simply a lack of technical knowledge. You need an understanding heart. That's what the fool needed. All right. Any other questions or comments? All right, let's close in prayer then.